Welcome back to the Front Page Football Podcast. It has been 4 long months, but we are back finally with another edition of the podcast. I am your host, Christian Marchetti, and tonight I am joined by Cody Ajayda and Matthew Olsen, and we are getting into a podcast for the first time in 4 months, first time since April, I believe. Might even be longer for a couple of these guys since they've actually done a podcast. I'm not sure, but let's get the introductions out the way to start off with. Cody, first of all, to you, how are you going on this Tuesday evening that we are recording?
I'm doing good, man. It's probably been a good 4 or 5 months since I've been on an FPF podcast. Unfortunately, I can't say it's been that long since I've been on a podcast in general, but I don't think we should be going into that, should we, Christian?
Yes, that is an excellent point. Cody, of course, you have your own podcast away from here, which you of course have had episodes on. So yeah, I've forgotten that. Matt, what about you? Take it away. When was your last podcast appearance?
I believe it was Christmas Eve morning at about 4 or 5 a.m. Western Australia time. Very iconic podcast that I did alongside Cody. And can't I just say, Christian, short of Greece in 2004 or the mutiny on the Bounty, this is one of life's great miracles happening before us, the return and revival of the Front Page Football Podcast.
Look, some said it was over, some doubted us, but we have put the naysayers firmly in the rearview mirror, and we are back, ladies and gentlemen. So what are we going to be talking about, since it is the end, as Cody Ajayda is absolutely pissing himself right now? It is.
Just a classic Matt intro. Fucking hell.
Matt's like, it's the first pod in like ages. We're going to throw like a massive Grease 2004 curveball out there and see if people can latch onto it.
Brilliant stuff. Crying real tears right now.
This is what I mean. Like, this is why, you know, this is why this needed to return. We are 2 minutes and 20 seconds into the pod and Cody is crying of laughter, and Matt has made a reference to Grease's Euro 2004 campaign. Some say ridiculous. I think it's absolutely spectacular, to be honest. But what are we going to talk about on the pod? So it is late August. The A-League does not start for another couple months, and the A-League Women a couple weeks after that. But we are nearing the end of NPL seasons across the country. We've had the Olympics just gone. So there are things still to get through, still things to talk about that we can kind of recap. So first thing we're going to go through is some A-League men's transfer news, essentially a wrap of all the major moves that have happened and kind of giving our thoughts on them. Then we'll get into some transfer news in the dub as well. And we've got two guys here who are very, very knowledgeable when it does come to the dub as well. And then we will get into a little bit about the NPLs, and I'll get Cody and Matt's thoughts as well on the Matildas Olympic campaign. So, boys, let's start with the transfer wrap-up in the A-League men. So, first thing we wanted to get into, let's talk about Auckland FC, because they are the new team, the new boys on the block. They have made signings that include Hiroki Sakai, Joey Champness, Callan Elliott, Jake Brimmer, Dan Hall, and a host of other Kiwi players as well, who some that have A-League experiences, some who don't. But probably the biggest move that they made and the one that's stirring the most controversy is the loan signing of Alex Paulson from AFC Bournemouth, who of course are owned by Bill Foley, who purchased Paulson initially from the Wellington Phoenix. And that move is subject to the FA approving changes to the what's known as the Caceres clause, which didn't allow basically multi-club owned A-League clubs to for their multi-club Jesus Christ, this is like, it's like multi-club is like in every two words. It's confusing me.
Let's, you can just say MCOs.
MCOs is the other way. Or I could just say this. Basically, when Anthony Caceres signed for Manchester City from the Central Coast Mariners and Manchester City loaned Anthony Caceres to Melbourne City, that caused a lot of controversy and such moves were blocked from MCO to MCO. But basically, Auckland and some other A-League clubs have been pushing for that to be overturned and gone back to normal. And it looks like that's going to happen if Football Australia passed the regulations for that to do so. So either of you want to give your thoughts on Auckland so far? They definitely seem like they're going to be ready for sure for their inaugural campaign. And it seems like they're pretty intent on making some noise as well.
I think what you have is probably a club that I think can comfortably sort of go through an A-League season, have their battles and be a top six team at the end of the day. I think questions probably lie with the leadership of, Jake Brimmer, who I still kind of firmly believe was, you know, one or two season hit wonder, even as the Johnny Warren medalist. I don't know if he's ready to be a leading figure for that team per se. And Steve Corica, you know, he's going to probably find the magic in another way. Danny Hay, someone that I have a relationship with and have interviewed before as well. Very nice recruitment to sort of have lured him back to WA.
That's friend of FPF, Danny Hay. Yep.
Friend of FPF, Danny Hay. Yep. And he was, he told me personally, like, I'm actually set. I want to be in WA for a while and I might even look at the glory job somewhere down the line. So whatever Auckland did to secure him back, massive statement of intent. Within the New Zealand football sphere. And just on that, you know, when I made those comments that I made about the Wellington Phoenix, one thing that I kind of wanted to talk about at the time was the fact that their youth pathways are going to be diminished. And it's another reason why I'm a little bit concerned about the future of the club. And I look at some of the recruitment here, and like you're saying, Christian, I think I'm looking at a name like a Cam Howison and guys like that, who they are going to make their mark as professionals, but they've come through that New Zealand system previously, and they've not really had time at the Phoenix, and they've not had time at other clubs in Australia. And so we're already seeing the kind of first steps that they've made in sort of being able to blood those players, quality players that, in the same way, when we speak of Alex Paulson, he wasn't really on our radar until we literally was on our radar in front of us performing at a really consistent level for the Phoenix. As far as the whole Caceres clause is concerned, I think that the main concern that we have with it dates back like 7 or 8 years, really. Melbourne City didn't really end up exploiting and taking control of things in the way that they wanted. And I personally believe that with the City Football Group, once the whole Aaron Moy situation happened and they made back money on their investment because his transfer to Huddersfield was so big, I don't know that they actually have the intent to manipulate the market as much per se. And so in that sense, I'm okay with being kind of lenient on it anyway. As far as Alex Paulson is concerned, I really think we should be asking him personally what the move meant, because I still think there's a future for him in probably English football or elsewhere throughout, making that move overseas. And I don't necessarily think this is a bad thing, but also people haven't really had this conversation. He's an Auckland native. And so him being at the club and him sort of intensifying that New Zealand derby, I think a big part of that is the fact that he's a local, and he probably actually did want to come back and play for the club. And the second he's arrived at Bournemouth, you know, they've probably had that conversation and he's wholeheartedly agreed to it. So, yeah, I understand the controversy with it, and I'm not excusing sort of, you know, the reason why it's a big deal, but I'm kind of sympathetic to it, if I'm honest.
Cody, your thoughts on the changing of the Caceres clause?
I hate it. I hate it.
Bang, 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 bang. 9 minutes in. Let's go. Let's do it.
No, why? Honestly, because there's three clubs in Australia that are probably genuinely under an MCO. It plays into a genuine sporting advantage. You have, I know, Matt, you kind of said Melbourne City haven't really tried to exploit it. The reality is the rule came in because they went out of their way to exploit it. It was there to at least provide a safeguard. I don't think it completely alleviated them sending players to other A-League or the A-League clubs that were under their ownership. I think it was just a 2-year blockage, so they couldn't just go pick someone up from one club and then drop them in another. if it was 2 years down the line, Paulson had a couple fouls, loan stints in England, and they wanted him to get home into familiar surroundings, I'd be all for it. But the fact that they've kind of just plopped him up out of one A-League club, chucked him in another, it's not even the Auckland organisation that I have a problem with. It's Bill Foley and how he's kind of come in as this big hotshot billionaire and gone, okay, I don't like this rule. Change it so that way I can make my team really, really good. That to me is what I can't stand. In terms of the move itself, it's probably going to be good for Auckland. Maybe it's, I don't see it having much of an advantage for Paulson himself, but just in general, it's the rule was a good safeguard for, I guess, the league as a whole. I don't like the fact that Auckland's been here for 2 seconds and they've managed to get it changed. I think it's really, really dumb. For Auckland overall, though, I actually don't mind their recruitment strategy. There's a lot of unknown New Zealand names. I'm not even going to sit here and say what they're like and what to expect from them because I don't know them a lot personally. But I'm still excited to see what they can bring to this competition. There's guys like Logan Rogerson, Max Matter, who do have a bit of European experience that may be able to come in and actually do something good in this league. Like I said, I haven't exactly seen them play in large amounts before, so I'm not going to sit here and say they're going to set the league on fire or anything. But it's exciting. I think it's that unknown quantity. There's some good first team players in there as well. Dan Hall, Jake Brimmer, proven A-League experience. I know you said he's a bit of a one-season wonder, Matt. Maybe he is, but being in fresh surroundings, I think it'll be interesting to see how he gets on there. Hiroki Sakai, that's a massive pull. I'm happy with that. But yeah, the Paulson move just left a bad taste in my mouth.
I guess the one really big qualm I have with that, Cody, is to immediately point the finger at a figurehead like a Bill Foley when the competition, like the one thing we need is stable ownership and good finances. Here is a guy who may quite literally revolutionize football in New Zealand and the Pacific because he got bored and he owns some wineries in the region. I mean, what a guy. He arrived in Las Vegas. Sorry, I'm a big National Hockey League fan, so I can speak to this. I despised the Vegas Golden Knights when they came into the competition. I hated everything that they stood for. But the fact of the matter was they had really aggressive recruitment to come and steal the coach from the Florida Panthers at the time, Jared Gallant, and they ended up going all the way to the Stanley Cup Finals. That is the aggression that a Bill Foley-inspired sporting organization can, you know, they can have that impact. Now, whether it's because Bill Foley's this really rich figure and he's immediately, you know, sort of said, how can we stir up some controversy? What can we do to give ourselves a really good competitive advantage? And the whole organization has come together to kind of find this outcome. I can see where people have a problem with that because it's kind of implying corruption in one way or another. But I'm going to be brutally honest. When it comes to repealing the Caceres clause, I just think that it would actually be a net benefit for our competition to be able to go to these bigger clubs and say, with the resources that you have, what can you do to aid us? Because that will look what it did for Australian football when we had Aaron Moy revolutionize his career. He went on to become a Socceroo for years and years thereafter, right? And captain the Socceroos behind Matt Ryan. And that was a benefit that CFG provided for us. And I know what's controversial about it.
You're bringing up Aaron Moy. They didn't bend any rules to bring in Aaron Moy. Western Sydney didn't want him. Melbourne City saw the talent. And they went, okay, yeah, we'll take him.
But obviously, CFG's influence played a big part in that. And Cody,
and the influence is good.
You're
I don't mind the influence.
He signed with Manchester City. He signed with Manchester City.
After the fact.
But they were able to use their influence to make that happen, right? That connection from Melbourne City to Manchester City still happened pretty seamlessly, and he went on to have a big impact, have a career in the Premier League. We were still able to get a net benefit from that, right?
That's the net benefit you want. Going to the league, asking them to change rules and how things work in this country so you can then build your side. That's the part that I have an issue with.
If you look at the Luke Braddons of the world, if you look at the Anthony Caceres of the world, when those respective moves happen, can you remember the seasons that they had thereafter? Like, can you?
Well, I can remember a season in Melbourne City. Bratton, they shouldn't have made that move in the first place. I thought that was a bit of a waste of time on their part. But What do you want them to
you're
do?
not even
Bring
sure,
in.
and you're not even sure while you're saying this that you, I mean, you said that Paulson, you weren't sure that it was the best move for his career, right? So,
No, I don't
I mean,
think it
if you're
is.
already at odds with like the respective moves that are being made, I just think we ought to open things up a little bit more. Because at the end of the day, it's not like we're going to take back the salary cap anytime soon. We just
No,
need to
but
find
my issue with the
innovative
Paulson move
ways.
isn't even to do with the fact that rules were bent to bring him over to the club. The reality is he had two choices in this offseason. He either stayed at Wellington Phoenix, stayed in the A-League, or he went to Europe. He's decided to stay in the A-League, but to go to a new club. When I say new club, I mean completely brand new. New surroundings for himself and new surroundings for where the club is. You don't know how they're going to go. And from what I've heard, it looks like he had a bit of a shocker in that friendly against the Wanderers. You're putting him in new surroundings at the same level that he was at before. If he performs well, it's nothing different to what Bournemouth knew beforehand. And if he doesn't perform well, it reduces their how he looks at his parent club's eyes. So I don't think he's going to get any net benefit out of this move. So I don't see why they would make it for him. Like if you're going to
Maybe
send
not.
if he's going to go to Bournemouth, give him a loan in Europe, give him a shot there. If you believe you're ready to spend 1.2 million on him or something, why not back into playing Europe?
Okay. Jesus Christ, we just did 15 minutes on Auckland alone. Okay, we need to move on. So elsewhere.
The other ones are pretty basic, to be fair.
Yeah. So we're just going to go through some of these a bit quicker. So Jane McLaren left Melbourne City. If you were listening to this podcast last season, we were saying throughout, like, he's definitely leaving. And there you go. Literally one of the least surprising pieces of transfer news this offseason. So he signed for a club in the Indian Super League. Melbourne Victory, meanwhile, have been very busy, along with appointing Patrick Isnorbo. Josh Rawlins has come in. Reno Piscopo, Jing Rees, Virgos, a new Greek striker, and Mitch Langrack is also going to be joining at the start of 2025. And they also brought in Jack Duncan, who I would think is essentially going to deputize for the first half of the season until Langrack comes and is ready. We're going to also talk a bit about Perth Glory, since Matt is here, because they have been undergoing a very, very serious rebuild under now the directorship of Stan Lazaridis and the managerial nous of Gengen Glory TM boss David Zrilic. So we've seen guys like Josh Risden, Brendan O'Neill come back home, and they've also picked up some more experienced guys like Nikola Miljusnic, Lockie Barr, and then some younger guys have come across from essentially other A-League academies. In Adam Bajaria, Faisal, Nathaniel Blair,
Bulgaria.
Thank you, Cody. And they've also signed someone like Taras Gamulka, who I think, you know, is like a really good sort of like buy low, sell high sort of signing, potentially for them. And Cody can speak to this. And I'm going to probably butcher his last name, but the NPL boy from Marconi, the Japanese midfielder,
Aoyama. Like, pretend you got hurt and then Yama.
Aoyama,
yeah. Not with the emphasis on the O, though.
Yeah.
That was probably incredibly racist. I do apologize.
Okay, so much business from Perth Glory. Matt, you've already written a little bit on the website recently about kind of Perth in the Australia Cup and their win over Melbourne City, and a little bit about kind of the new vibe around the place at the moment. But I guess, can you speak a little bit more to the new signings and essentially this new rebuild?
Yeah, look, I won't waste too much time actually getting into the weeds of the team and things like that. I just think there's another time to have that conversation, especially with the way they're playing at the moment. But I actually, like, when you break it down, I think there's still cause for concern. When looking at the cup performance that they had against Melbourne City, that huge 5-4 scoreline is, you know, that's kind of what they want to aid going against, is leaking so many goals, because it's wasting the potential of many of the players in that team. And I'm worried that the core of the team now is still built in an attacking way. You know, all due respect to kind of Lockie Barr, I mean, where else are these, where are the defensive sort of reinforcements? When you look at the recruitment of someone like a Josh Risden, his asset is actually kind of going forward, kind of on the wing, being able to use his pace and that. So I don't even really know where to begin in terms of sort of understanding defensively what they've done. But obviously that's really the only negative is, are they going to actually concede a lot of goals again? And if they do, are they able to overcome that? And that's where I would say, look, they're probably still showing signs that they can. It's just the defensive reinforcements haven't really come. I know there's obviously Hamzaoui, who is the Moroccan-Belgian signing from Sangliers or whatever that club in Belgium is called. And he's someone that, as far as I understand, has not even arrived in Western Australia yet. He has not been at the training sessions in Fremantle. They've got a friendly tonight against Sorrento. He's not anywhere to be found. So I don't know if he's actually arrived yet. And for one of your key defensive signings, one of your key international players, I don't know, you'd like someone like that to be around right about now. But yeah, you can point to Perth Glory's recruitment in one of two ways. One, the experience and the homecoming of the likes of Brandon O'Neill, who wrote that very heartfelt open apology. You know, the likes of Josh Risden again. He sat down with Ben Smith the other day and had a wonderful chat with him. Just really nice seeing that insight. And the fact that those guys are together with an Adam Taggart, that West Australian connection really means a lot, mixed in with Nathaniel Blair, Kwan and Go, you know, all of this incredible young talent. Adam Bugaria, it's just he's not put a single foot wrong since he's arrived as well. So
hey, what the hell, Matt? Hey, Matt just pronounced it like I did, but Cody, you didn't correct him.
No, I said Bugaria.
You said Bugaria, but then Cody stepped in
and was like giving it like the European accent and all that kind of.
Oh,
like,
I don't need the European accent, but like get the G right.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Okay. All right. Fair enough. Whatever. Whatever, whatever.
Anyway, that's Perth.
That's Perth. Yeah. So elsewhere, Marco Rojas is back in Phoenix colours. And they also picked up Paolo Retre and also the new goalkeeper that they've got, whose name escapes me off the top of my head, but obviously played he's come out of Tottenham's youth academy.
The English Nigerian guy.
Yep. We're just gonna now kind of call it's like the Japanese NPL guy that Perth have signed. It's like we're just gonna start referring to players.
Japanese
like
NPL guy.
Very, very professional. Yeah, Wellington looking to kind of stem the bleeding of some of the players that they've lost in the offseason. Sydney FC, meanwhile, they've kind of been busy. Well, in the last kind of couple of weeks, they've secured the signing of Leo Senna, the Brazilian midfielder. And then about a month ago, they also signed, and here's another last name I'm probably going to butcher, Anas
Owahim.
Okay, there we go. That's, yep. So he's also joined the club too. So two foreign midfield reinforcers for Sydney. Cody, what's your thoughts on those signings?
I don't really know a lot about them, to be honest. And
there's a lot of positivity surrounding Senna. Yeah, there's a lot of positivity surrounding the Senna signing.
Yeah, I've seen it, but I think there's downsides to him as well. Like you're talking about a guy that, no, at one stage was a good Serie A player, was on the verge of a move to a big club in Italy, went back to Brazil, was playing fourth tier most recently. I think people can probably read into it either way too much. I think you've got people saying it's going to be one of the best sixes in the league, and then other people saying it's going to be really, really shit. But I think it's probably going to be somewhere in the middle. I wouldn't be surprised. And look, I haven't looked too deep into this guy, but if you're going from Serie A to, well, Italian Serie A to Brazilian Serie D, my guess is something's possibly gone wrong in your personal or professional life. He's probably had to take a reset. Maybe he was recovering from injury and just needed to go to a low level to get match fitness. So it could have been something like that. Maybe he needed to go home and that was the best place he could get a short-term contract. But look, the fact that he's been at a higher level suggests that there is good quality there. I think it just depends how well you can get out in Australia. I think international signings are always going to be hit and miss. There's so many factors that you've got to take into account. How well they settle in, how well they are able to adapt to the culture, the heat. No, there's Brazilians that come here and do absolutely fantastic. There's Brazilians that come here and, you know, you can't wait to see the back of them. So you don't really know how these things are going to go. So I'm probably going to reserve my judgment until I actually physically see him play in a Sydney jersey.
Yeah, there's been a lot of positivity around that signing, and particularly around how Senna was playing for Spezia in Serie A, and he was doing well for quite a period there. But if I'm not mistaken, I think I read it the other day. I think it was by from Aussie Scout. He was actually absent from professional football for 2 years, and that was after his Serie A stint. So I'm not too
There's a good
sure.
chance something may have actually gone wrong in his
Yeah,
life.
I'm not
That's
too
why he's
sure
taken a step back.
exactly what the reasons were behind that, but it definitely seems like the type of signing where if you can get him right, the upside is really high. So I don't mind it, but definitely there are risks involved with that approach to visa signings in particular. It's better than Perth signing Hamzawi, who's not even training yet, which is giving me serious Jason Bothomia vibes. With the Newcastle Jets last season, who didn't actually play at all for Newcastle and was like the biggest waste of space
Does anyone know how
imaginable.
much he was on for
So,
salary?
no, but that was just like,
Whatever
it's
it was
like,
too much.
imagine like just turning the knife even more, where it's like we don't even have owners and now it's like we've got a visa player who's just like completely
Literally
redundant.
having a holiday in Newcastle.
Pretty much. Yeah. So it's like number one on the list of criteria for visa signings is please tell me
Play.
he's going to start preseason like straight away with like everyone else. Because if he doesn't, I'm going to start getting worried. But who knows? Maybe it will still work out and it'll be all good with Hamzawi. But anyway, let's move on to some guys who left the competition and some young guys. So, namely Nestorio Incunda. Who I won't be able to now anymore. Basically, just drive half an hour every couple of weeks and go and see his brilliance. So, although I'm absolutely delighted for him that he got the move, it's kind of a little bit of a bummer from that standpoint. But he has been, I think he's completely eclipsed everyone's expectations of him since joining Bayern Munich. He's been fantastic in preseason. Clearly, looks like he's settled well. He's been scoring and assisting with the senior team in friendlies. And it's just pretty remarkable that like a player who 2 years ago was just an impact player off the bench in the A-League is just like, yeah, like I can probably come off the bench in the Bundesliga on opening day and like maybe make an impact for Bayern Munich. Like we're kind of at that stage with him, which is just kind of insane. And Ben Old is another one that we wanted to know here. Because he started in Saint-Étienne's first Ligue 1 game in France. Look at this. See, now with the French stuff, this is where I make my bones with these pronunciations and the Italian stuff. All right, not these like
Lego.
yes. That wasn't you weren't pronouncing one. You were just grunting. That's what that was. So anyway.
Was worse.
So
I'll make it up. I'll make it up. The Wellington Phoenix goalkeeper, Joshua Olawanyami.
there we go. Bang. Matt Olsen back in the game. But Ben Old, I think Saint-Étienne lost that first game, but I think it was to Monaco. But from all reports, he did quite well. And like side note, Wellington's ability to export guys like into top five leagues or top 10 leagues is it's really, really impressive. Just think of Sarpreet Singh years ago and Kekache even. So yeah. Keen to monitor how he goes. Max Ballard is also another guy that I wanted to mention because he has started really well for NAC Breda in the Eredivisie, playing every minute in the league so far. They just won against Ajax as well, 2-1 over the weekend. So yeah, and Henry Hoare too is out on loan at Gangwon in the K League. I'm sure maybe Matt can speak to that. Scored the winner on the weekend. They're 4 points clear at the top. I don't think any of us realized that Henry Hoare was just joining like a team which was contending for the title in the K League. I think that just kind of flew under the radar. But yeah, overall there, those four guys, great starts. What's with you two? Is any story there that, I mean, Erin Kunda is the obvious one, but with Old Ballard, Henry Hoare, those guys are kind of really impressing too, aren't they?
It's a very impressive story with Henry Hoare because he's on loan. I find that really bizarre. If he can make that move permanent, Gangwon will be playing in the Champions League Elite group stage. So that'll be a really, really cool opportunity for him. Am I correct in saying that is Calvert still with Gangwon?
Don't believe so.
Okay.
There's Fair Alex enough. Popovich is at Guangzhou, I want to say. Stop my head. Guangzhou, yeah. So I'm not too sure. I'll keep talking about it. I'll just do a quick search of Aaron Calvert just to make sure we get this right. But yeah, you can keep
Aussies
going.
Abroad, it is pretty remarkable to have obviously seen Daniel Benny get minutes. Of course, I was going to mention that one. Friend of FPF, I've sent him a few DMs here and there, and he's doing really well at QPR. So he was surprised after the first few training sessions how well he did to actually settle in and then get the minutes against Tottenham as well. I really hope Ange had a word with him, because I know he was pretty disappointed to not have made the Young Socceroos squad. So yeah, obviously I'm quite biased because I've got a personal relationship with him. But Daniel Benny, if that QPR side can have a stable season and he can get minutes, that'll be a really, really big benefit for the A-League, I think.
I love how we're so obsessed with Aussies abroad that we're like, whenever two Aussies are on opposing teams in a game, we're like, oh, did they have a conversation afterwards? Did they catch up?
I mean, that's just Aussies when you go overseas, isn't it?
Yeah, I know. But it's just like, yeah, it's just funny. It's like, I'm sure like all the Brazilian Serie A supporters are like, whenever there's an export, which is like there's about 10 to Europe, like every single month, every single window. And they're all just like, hey, did, I don't know, Rodrigo and Rafinha catch up after the Clásico? Like,
but you see it here. Probably every time not. Brazilians play against each other, they always have a chat after the game.
Yeah, maybe. But that's like because it's in Australia. Like, they rarely come to Australia.
We rarely get players in Europe.
Yeah, okay. Fine, you proved my point. Yeah, okay, fine. Your logic was better. Get in the bin.
Always is.
Anyway, not touching that. Aaron Calvert is in the K-League as well, just for clarification, with Dejon Hanna, who are second bottom. And I am not going to start a Matt Olsen Asian tangent right now, but I just realized John Book are actually bottom of the K-League, which I had no idea, which is kind of insane because they're meant to be one of the biggest clubs in Korea.
Delbridge with Incheon as well. Delbridge would be with Incheon.
Yeah, Delbridge in the K-League still. Yeah, of course, Harrison Delbridge. But John Wood being bottom also explains more, which I think was the next thing I was going to get into, some other major transfers. Probably explains why Jong Tae-wook was maybe more open to a loan move to Western Sydney. So that's a nice little segue. That's a transfer which is kind of, a sneaky, maybe under the radar, could be a really, really good get for the Wanderers. Bozidar Krajev joining them as well was a massive domestic transfer. Hiroshi Ibusuki, another big domestic transfer, going to Western United. And then Kai Truan joining Melbourne City. MacArthur have been heavily on their recruitment with Chris Economides, Luke Bratton, Liam Rose, and Marin Yakalis all joining. Again, a lot of guys there who have been at other A-League clubs. Mariners replacing Jacob Farrell, who went to Portsmouth, with Lucas Moragas from Newcastle. And also Apostolos Stamatolopoulos, who unfortunately has actually just suffered a 6-week injury, which is really frustrating. But he, of course, got his big move to Motherwell in Scotland as well. And he, it seems, is going to be followed by Josh Nisbet potentially moving to Scotland too. He's been linked with Ross County, much to the disappointment of the Oz football community, who clearly think that Josh Nisbet is much better than Ross County. Ross County's been popping a lot of strays from the Nisbet fan base. So any transfers there that really stick out to you as well, whether that's the Aussies who have exported themselves to Europe or the other way?
I'm intrigued by MacArthur's business. I think, considering especially how last season ended with a myriad of controversy around them, they've recruited really well. It doesn't look like any of the people that are, or maybe one of the players that was involved, is still around, at least contracted. We don't really know what the situation is with that in a legal sense. We aren't those kinds of journalists. But yeah, to bring in likes of Economides, Braddon, Liam Rose, I think is a really interesting one as well. Mari Niaculish, I'm a little bit intrigued by that as well. Not someone that I see setting the league alight, but a solid signing nonetheless. I'm intrigued to see how it goes. There's a lot of senior quality, which I think is really, really good. It'll be a little bit of maybe a bit of missing experience that they needed in key areas. Bratton, I still think, can be the best six in the league when he's at his best. So I think there's a lot to like there. I think they'll, at the very least, maintain a top six position if they can keep it up. I'm intrigued to see what they can add with some of the young players coming through. Dean Bosanjak's someone that I think I could point to as someone that could probably be a decent player to at least watch out for when he's ready. There was another name that I had on written down. Oh, one of your old mates, Christian, someone who I think could be making an impact for them this season. Arioch Piol scored his first A-League goal last season. I reckon
Hang on,
he's
apparently I'm mates with Arioch Piol. Who
South
knew?
Australian. You all know each other. It's not a big place.
I never actually had a one-on-one encounter with Arioch
Yeah,
Piol,
well, you know
so
what? He's from the same city, so it's close enough, and it's not the largest city in the world. You and Antonis even said it when I went over there. You have a knack for knowing each other in
oh,
South
Adelaide is a
Australia.
small town. Adelaide is a
It
small town. But yeah, Arioch, I mean, Arioch Piol showed signs definitely last year.
I'm intrigued to
And
see what he can do this season as well. Thank you. If he's a real part of that senior group, maybe not a starter week in, week out, but someone that's given an opportunity, especially off the bench, he'll win your point. He'll win MacArthur points.
I'm definitely intrigued. Particularly because someone like Ali Orgler is not there anymore. He's moved on. So again,
That's a move
there's
I'm a bit disappointed in. I think he's someone that would have been really, really good for McCarthy. I thought he was a fantastic player. I'm disappointed to see him move on, but I'm intrigued to see how someone goes coming from the A-League, who was a solid young player, to the Iraqi Premier League. It'll be interesting to see how the quality matches up.
Okay, that's going to do it for our wrap of the A-League men's transfer news. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we are going to get into some discussion about the A-League women's side of things. Okay, we're back and we're talking about A-League women transfers and transfer exodus in the A-League women. And namely, we're going to talk about this trend which is happening where we've seen 13 players this offseason move from the A-League Women to the newly formed professional USL Super League. Now, guys, if I'm not mistaken, that's a second tier competition in the US, below the
It's funny,
NWSL.
actually. Technically, it's got first division status. So it's meant to be in line with the NWSL.
Okay.
And if you ask people that are into that league, it is a first tier competition. I think it's a second. I'm viewing it as a second tier competition. I don't care for schematics, but technically, it does have that first division status, and it is meant to be at the top of a football pyramid.
So some of the players that have moved there, so non-Americans, is it Morgan Aquino, Amina Ekic are some names which stand out. But there are, I mean, we're gonna get in discussion. There are a lot of American natives who actually have moved to this division, but I think it's still there's some weight here in the discussion around the A-League women's lack of professionalism, which I'm sure you guys are gonna get into. But Hope Breslin, Vicky Bruce, Hannah Keane are some players which stand out there. Cody, let's start with you. Are you like, how much worry is there with something like this trend?
I think it's more frustration than anything, because there was a time where the A-League Women's maybe wasn't on par with the NWSL, but players from the NWSL viewed it as a good place to go to because it was one of the most professional places you could go to for women's football outside of America. We had top quality players from even places like England that would come to the A-League because they wanted that increased professionalism. And if you talk to international players that come to Australia, one thing they'll tell you is the way the clubs operate in their women's spaces is some of the most professional that they'll see around the world. Literally, the one thing that holds them back is how much remuneration you're getting for playing. That is where they fall way short. And unfortunately, that's the most important thing when you're talking about the difference between playing part-time or playing full-time, needing to hold possibly another job. It's not necessarily that this USL has been formed. It just means that there's 10 more options for players to go to in America where they can earn a full-time living wage, and it's going to take talent out of Australia. I think it's a really, really frustrating state of affairs. And I know what the argument will be. It'll be the fact that, oh, how are you going to set up professionalism? How are you going to do it now when the A-League's borderline broke? And I think if you're asking the question right now, we're in a position where it is going to be really, really hard to invest enough in the A-League women's that it can be professional. But 2 years ago, I think it was, we got a $140 million cash injection into the league. And I'm sure everyone can admit that where that money went was pretty poor. Like, besides trying to prop up the COVID stuff and prop up Perth Glory, I reckon you take the $30 million that you spent on Keep Up and you put that into professionalizing the women's game. You're talking, let's just say, a $600,000 salary cap. No, maybe $1 million salary cap for each club that funds it for 2.5 years of professional competition. That's possible. It was quite simple when we got that cash injection to be able to do so. I maybe wouldn't have done it straight away. I would have waited till the World Cup was done and then done it from that point. But now we're in a position where it doesn't even look like an option, which is kind of sad because we had a golden opportunity to do something like that and drive women's sports forward in this country. And the prior decisions robbed us of that chance, which is sad. But now we missed that boat. USA, they've got money to burn in football, clearly. They're investing in it. They're reaping the rewards of it. It's lessons that we've got to take in the future. And I know they've got this target for 2030 for professionalism. You're doing well if you're leaving it that late, because a lot of leagues around the world are going to surpass us that we realistically should be better than. I think that people really need to sit down and go, okay, how there's growing professionalism around the world in women's football. How do we make sure we're not left behind, one, and two, how do we get back to where we once were in the women's space?
I actually just want to have more of a conversation about the United Soccer League as it is, as an organization, because I have an invested interest in the USL through the Oakland Roots. And what I find very interesting about it is that they do a lot of sort of budget cutting in the right areas, but also, like, just in terms of it being set up from scratch as a second division, they were able to get a TV deal with the ESPN. They were able to, you know, compromise with the collegiate system to help collegiate players funnel into the league, which, for women's soccer, you have to understand that's a really big deal, because how many players have you got sitting in the wings in literally hundreds of colleges, you know, from California all the way to New York, right? It's like there's a lot of players there in that pool that can really help prop up a professional league from scratch. And just as a bit of a history lesson, the USL technically didn't just start. It existed previously under the name of the W League, which is hilarious. But the USL just it's a really important footnote to how you can actually really get that started. And the blueprint for both the women's and men's competition is something the FA should look at, with, of course, our own national second division conversation as well, because there's some very important lessons to learn on how that can be done. Yeah, I mean, I look at this especially from the point of, if we can get like a memorandum of understanding, or if we can get some benefits from a lot of the players going here and understanding how that can kind of funnel back into our game, that would be really, really important. Because ultimately, and I hate to say it, we're not the Europes of the world in terms of what our football is. We are a franchise league. So we're better off trying to make the A-League Women's like the USL or like the NWSL, where even between the two leagues, they have this very important sort of fluctuation. I know that in one of the conferences at the end of 2023, I think the North Carolina Courage under 23s won one of the conferences there as well to make the playoffs. And that's just an example of the fact that that's the NWSL kind of funneling itself through to the USL. So anything that we can sort of look at to that competition to be able to sort of feedback for our own players and for our own benefit is really crucial.
I think I got one question I actually kind of want to pose to both of you. And funnily enough, Christian, I think it was one that Antonis asked to us almost this time last year, actually. But it comes back to how the A-League was created. Football in Australia needed basically a hard reset. And the powers that be that decided that the A-League should begin decided, well, football in this country is going to be professional now. Either you invest in a club enough that you can play players a full-time wage, or you move to the side and create room for basically people that can. Yeah, look, there was mistakes that were made when the A-League, there wasn't really an integration process to then develop a full-scale pyramid, but I think we're learning now that there are significant challenges in that happening or being able to occur at the very least, but and it's probably a change that could have occurred after the World Cup, but would you be in favour, either of you, of the A-League turning around and going from this year, let's let it be 2, 3, 4 years in the future, we're going to require that the A-League is professional. If you, we're going to have, even if they have to reduce the amount of licences, let's just say they put in 8 instead, if you are willing to front up the cash for your club to operate as a professional football team, you can maintain your licence. If you're not able to do that, give it up and we'll give it to someone that will. What do you think of that? I'm not saying it's the idea that I choose. I'm just curious what you guys think.
One point that I'd actually make on that is if you're actually going to just about restart women's football in the same way that the A-League was formed, wild idea here, but remove the entire concept of the women's competition from the APL and give it back to the FA. More resources. Would that work?
I'll tell you another idea that you could do, and it takes someone to front up the cash for it, unfortunately.
Yeah.
But the WSL has just been bought by a private investor. Would there be a private investor that would be willing to do the same in Australia?
Well, but that's just back to my point on the USL, right? The USL, the reason why it works so well, especially in the women's front where there's, you know, less sort of, I guess, money in it and less, you know, spectator interest and TV and so on. The reason why it works so well is because it knows what it is. If a team in Houston has to play at a college football stadium where they've got all the paint all over the lines, and I mean, you can very clearly tell it's got the branding of the university and everything like that, and heck, the net might even have the wheels on it. Like, it's tin pot stuff, but here's the thing. The metrics of that end up working if it means you get a TV deal on ESPN, you get a cash injection from the people helping to be a part of it. The university would be paying the club to be a tenant as well. There's a lot of revenue streams. It just comes from being humble about it, understanding what you are. Instead of trying to bring down all the bells and whistles, you know, you actually are starting from a standpoint where you kind of give the onus to other people to help you springboard. And I think when we look at the formation of the A-League, that's exactly what we did with Westfield and Bowie Group. We said, you guys are really competent business people. Let's find a way for you to market this to us, and we'll kind of roll off and go from there. And so if women's football really wanted to try something like that in Australia, I'm serious. Reach out to the rugby league clubs of the world. You know, reach out to places where they can really help you get a revenue stream going. And that private investment can come in ways that you wouldn't imagine, even if it distorts our image slightly. I think Australians are really scared of that, whereas Americans aren't. And that's really important when, like I was saying, with the collegiate pool of players as well, there are a lot of advantages they have that we don't, and they do the bare minimum. We still ask for more when we don't necessarily have the resources to back ourselves up. I find that interesting.
Just one thing for both of you, though, on this. It's about private investment. And Matt, you're talking about the optics of that with the Australian public, but how about the optics of that to the football public, given what we're seeing in the last 4 years with private investment on the men's side and the criticism of Silver Lake and the fact that the APL don't have to show their books, they don't have to be transparent. Like, wouldn't there be fears that something similar could be replicated on the women's side?
One thing that I've found with people that are investing in the women's game, I think there's one, you're almost that desperate for money and a cash injection to prop yourself up that you're not necessarily questioning how that money's coming about. But I feel like, and this might be a weird way to look at it, but most people that I see investing in women's football aren't ethically unambiguous. So you don't necessarily need to hold those questions about them. Like, they're pretty upfront with what they want to do, how they're getting their money, and how they want to spend it. And I think if you've got people like that in place, yeah, they're rich and they've probably, you don't know how they've got their money per se. But if they're good people on the surface level and they're willing to not just invest in women's football, but invest in women, people aren't going to complain about it because you're putting your money to an ethical use. You're helping a part of society that needs assistance in growing grow. I think that's a good thing.
Matt, anything to add on this discussion?
Well, dude, I would say that the kind of can of worms that you might be opening there as well is this really big talking point in sort of AFL and NRLW circles. Is it like, should with, because we know that men's sport can have these issues with its private funding and with, you know, certain teams, you know, having a certain aura about the way they do their business, and are they ever really going to change? And, you know, the questions that we ask of a lot of successful franchises in sport with, you know, the transition of a lot of that funding. I'm just wondering if it kind of opens up the conversation for, like, basically just completely splitting off and doing your own thing. Should we just have a women's competition that's not attached to the A-League branding in any way and see if it fares off any better? Because, you know, I understand that that would even put, like, say, for example, with Melbourne Victory, I remember last season, Cody, talking to you about the whole 7-7 partners situation and how if that derails slightly, that's really going to, you know, it's really going to hamper the women's season because of all the budget cuts and things like that. They're the ones that bear the brunt of it, even though, like, their whole investment is about the Melbourne Victory branding and the men's team and where all that money is sort of coming from to begin with. So it's an interesting conversation to have. That being said, looking at the USL as a blueprint, the USL teams are all sort of just taken from the men's branding as well. You have, you know, again, the Oakland Soul are basically the exact same club as the Oakland Roots. You know, and North Carolina Courage, as I said, they had their team come over as basically the youth team into the competition. So they're just, there's a lot of kind of yanking off other brands in a way. But I would just really like to sort of open up that conversation and see if, in a way, that would be bit more beneficial for the parties that that are concerned.
Okay. Elsewhere in Dub transfer news, there's a lot of young players, so similar to the A-League men's side, really. A lot of young young Australian talent has left our shores and moved on to European clubs. So Jamila Rankin, Daniela Galic, and they're two main ones. We've also seen Vesna Milivojevic, Emma Ilioski, Cody Ilioski. I think that's correct.
Yes, it is.
Yes, that one was definitely much more straightforward. hopefully, well done, hopefully anyone of Macedonian background listening was delighted. North Macedonian background, I should say, was delighted with that pronunciation. Kate Taylor, Macy Fraser as well, moving on to Europe too. Also seeing some more experienced players like Jada Wyman and Stacey Papadopoulos moving on to Europe too. So definitely the same similar sort of exporting of talent as the men's game, which kind of leads to the last point of the discussion with this, which is, I'm just going to make this a really general question. Is the A-League woman, when we factor in the lack of professionalism, when we factor in this basically aura that players still feel like Europe is the ultimate goal, is it essentially just a no-brainer that the A-League women is going to become a development league just like the A-League men's?
I think the way the pecking order of women's football's moved around, it kind of has to be. But we've got the talent where we can develop our players, sell them on, get fees in, and that sustains you. You know, we're talking about professionalism, where the money's going to come from. This is where it comes from. More money's being invested into women's football. Transfers are going to go through the roof eventually. If the A-League can really hold itself down as a hotbed for talent in women's football, they're going to make some bank. You're looking at transfers of, I think, the top of women's football right now. You're looking at the kind of 500 to 750K mark. We're selling players right now for around the 50 mark. So you're talking maybe just under 10 times what the world peak is. I can tell you now, we're not there in the men's side of the game. Like, if that was the case, we'd be selling players for regularly 15 to 20 million a pop. That's the equivalent that the A-League Women's is at right now to if you're talking about men's football. So we're not that far off, I guess, the top leagues in the world in terms of how much people are willing to pay for our players. These ones that I've just gone through now, Ilioski, Daniela Galic, Jada Wyman, even if those players go to Europe and they do well, obviously these transfers have come from a snowball effect of other players going to Europe and doing well. These players do well now. More clubs are looking at Australia going, oh, yeah, we'll pick this person, we'll pick that person, especially in Scotland as well, where they have a professional league. And there, I've watched some women's Scottish Premier League games. The quality is not better than the A-League Women's. If anything, it's probably significantly worse, other than the top three teams in the league. And you'll see regularly those games will be blowout scores as well when those three teams play literally anyone else. But look, it's a good thing. I hope these players go on, they do well. Jamila Rankin going to the Bundesliga as well is absolutely fantastic. If they go in, they're able to make an immediate impact. More money gets invested into the A-League. More clubs come buy our players. Maybe we start pushing to sell players closer to that 100K mark. And if you're getting that for a women's footballer, the club's making bank compared to what their investment is in it thus far.
Okay, NPL, NPL. Let's talk a little bit about that, shall we? So it's been a really it's actually been really fascinating across the board in a lot of the NPL leagues this year. And I know Matt is here. Matt is going to give us his 2 cents on Olympic Kingsway. But I think I'm going to guess that me and Cody are going to be driving a lot of this discussion outside of that, if I had to make a prediction. But yeah. So Metro Stars here in South Australia, South Melbourne and Victoria, Gold Coast Knights under the stewardship of Scott McDonald in Queensland, and Rochdale Alinden in New South Wales. Those four clubs have all won their premierships in their respective states. For Gold Coast Knights, that's 2 years in a row. Metro Stars, 2 years in a row as well. And so those leagues are done in terms of regular season, and finals is either underway or about to get underway. And then if we're talking elsewhere in WA, which Matt, I'll get your thoughts now, actually. Olympic Kingsway are pretty much have all but secured the NPL WA Premiership. And you also actually gave some insights into them recently on the website after they played the Edgeworth Eagles in the Australia Cup. Had a chat with Mitch Oxburgh. They've got a very talented team for an NPL level, particularly NPL WA level league. So just maybe some words on them and what they've been able to do this season to kind of revolutionize their squad and kind of go all out essentially for the premiership. And of course we'll look to back it up in the final series.
Final series per se, we do something called the Top Four Cup. It's a little bit different. It's basically like we don't actually want the competition to have a final series, but here's this extra competition that we're having. It's weird.
So sorry, just quickly,
Christian.
Tasmania did that last year where it was first past the post, and then they were just like, yeah, look, let's just do this postseason series as well. But
Yeah,
yeah.
but it actually, I guess it kind of works because think about like a League Cup, right? Because they have the State Cup, which then qualifies for the National Australian Cup, and then the top four teams get together and have a competition in the postseason. Literally, it still kind of works as a secondary cup, like a League Cup. So in that sense, it's fine. It's just that obviously it molded from being a final series that all the clubs collectively agreed we didn't really want to be a final series anymore. But here's one thing I'll say is my NPL IQ has gone up tenfold this winter.
Well
I
done.
have
Well
actually,
done, Matt.
yes, I have attended multiple games and I can tell you a lot about what's going on with our respective clubs over in WA. So all due respect to what literally would be one of the best Western Australian squads ever assembled in Olympic Kingsway. Actually, there are a few different situations I want to talk about across the league. Perth Red Star, who's had a really decent season with their A-League talent, Kingsway have run away with the competition, and they are, as I said, they probably are on paper one of the best teams you could ever really assemble, especially for that level. But there's some very interesting dynamics going on as well, because Inglewood, who were in the Australian Cup in 2023, they have had a horrendous season. I don't even know that they've finished the season with double-digit points. I may have to double-check on that one, but like, they have had a horrendous season down the bottom. And the team that could potentially be getting relegated with them in 11th to go down to the playoffs at this point, very likely, is Perth Glory, which is relevant because you'll remember on this very same podcast about 2 years ago, maybe, yeah, no, it sounds about right, we got into a really big debate because I was staunchly defending Queensland and Western Australia's decision at the time to protect Brisbane Roar and Perth Glory from not getting relegated at the NPL level. Now, that legislation ended up changing from Football West, and Perth Glory, their youth squad wasn't doing so flash. So they've decided to get Faisal and Kwanango and Bagaria and all of these guys and stack them into the team to play a fixture against Perth Red Star, who, okay, obviously a very, very talented team. But again, this is a team that, I mean, we're talking about, there were the two leading goal scorers of the National Australian Cup in that 11. And they very embarrassingly lost the game. So it looks like Perth Glory are determined to be going to a relegation playoff. And that is unprecedented for the West Australian standard. So the NPLWA has actually delivered a really, really exciting campaign and some storylines that are still yet to play out. But ultimately, this Olympic Kingsway team, if there's a WA team that you want playing in the round of 16 against A-League opposition, yeah, it's this team on paper. They are incredible.
Yeah, no, just quickly, I'll just give a little bit more on this since Matt is here and he can provide some insights. But yeah, so Fremantle City aren't guaranteed yet a top four spot. There are still, Bayswater City could still catch them. Armidale would have to probably win all their games though to make it too. Stirling Macedonia look like they'll be in there probably with Fremantle City with third and fourth. So you basically got Kingsway, Perth Red Star, Fremantle City, Stirling Macedonia for the top four cup. And yeah, basically Perth Glory are going to need to win all three of their games remaining to have any chance of avoiding that relegation playoff. So yeah, a lot of work for them to do. Okay. Cody, Rockdale winning the premiership, is a big story in the NPL New South Wales. They've been the most consistent team all season there as well. Just a few words on their success this season.
Oh, they've been absolutely fantastic. Outside of the, I guess, clubs preparing for the NSD, they've probably got the best squad on paper at this level around Australia, I'd even argue. You're talking about a guy in Alec Kudoshevsky. I wouldn't even say he can play at an A-League level. I genuinely believe he could start at a fair few A-League clubs. He's that good.
I would say that he can bake at a Premier League level.
Hey, he's a man of many talents, man. Like, honestly, he's the sort of person I'd be jealous of. Like, man's bona fide athlete, great footballer, can cook. Let's be real, decent looking bloke too. He's got to have something wrong with him there, surely. I don't know what it is, but man's got to have a flaw somewhere. But it's interesting how Rockdale have actually been able to...
Cody, a reminder that you are getting married in a month's time, but yes.
Yes, and my fiancé loves me very much. But back to Rockdale, the fact that they've actually been able to pull away from Marconi, who them themselves had a very, very good squad, you guys would be aware of. James Tumbukowski, who's been banging in goals for them after doing it in Metro Stars. But to be able to pull away, as we speak, they're 7 points ahead, obviously. Got the title wrapped up already, but to have such a large gap when, for a lot of this season, the title race was actually quite close, and RPR and Blacktown looked like they were going to have something to say in it too. For them to be able to pull away so far towards the end of the season is an absolutely fantastic testament to what their abilities and what they're capable of doing, especially considering Marconi haven't exactly been on a losing streak recently either. They've been putting the pressure on just as much. So fantastic work by them. RPR may be slightly disappointing. They, especially in the last few rounds, I think they've let their standards slip a little bit. I'm a little bit surprised. They've kind of dip down the way that they have. But look, it's a competitive league in New South Wales. There's a lot of teams that are at very similar levels to each other. So I guess you can give them a bit of grace. They've at least look like they're going to consolidate top four, which should really be expectations for them. But I think what would be interesting actually for you, Christian, the relegation battle. Hills, unless they can avoid produce a miracle on the final day, look like they're going to be going down as a team to go straight relegated. Sydney FC's youth team and Central Coast Mariners' youth team are the other two battling for the playoff spot. So I'm a little bit intrigued to see how that final day plays out because it looks like...
Yeah, and also quick shout out to, what is his name? And I saw him score a hat-trick against Wollongong. I watched the highlights the other week. The Central Coast Mariners' young boy, Cody, help me out.
Arthur De Lima?
Yeah, Lima. Yeah, De Lima.
He's almost single-handedly going to save Central Coast Mariners from relegation.
No, and I'm mentioning him now because he signed a three-year scholarship deal today at the day that we are recording this.
Against Wollongong.
Yeah. Yeah,
but that'll be interesting because I think I would be surprised if it's not Sydney FC's youth team in that relegation playoff. But with how the second division in New South Wales is playing out, MacArthur's coming second in that competition, so it'll be both those two sides playing for that spot in the NPL next year, which I think will be a fantastic match.
Mm-hmm. No, it's very, very intriguing. Now, I'll give my 2 cents on the SA situation, of course. So, Metro Stars. Basically, in South Australia this season, we had a premiership race where no one really wanted it all season, with Metro Stars being inconsistent. So were Campbelltown, Modbury. The Modbury Jets for most of the season looked like they were gonna be the premiers, but then they faded towards the end, probably because of the Australia Cup commitments. And then Adelaide City, who finished fourth, have an incredible season where they were in the relegation zone after seven rounds, then went on an incredible winning streak, and then kind of found some consistency with their form and ended up finishing fourth. So Metro, in the end, getting the job done, finishing first, despite losing James Tomalkowski, who moved to Marconi, despite losing Austin Ayubi, who moved to Adelaide United, despite you losing their goalkeeper, Isaac Carmody, who moved to Scotland, and also their captain and leader, Anthony Salanga, who retired as well. So a very good achievement from them to still win the premiership. And the finals has begun in SA as well. And Metro are facing Adelaide City in one semi-final, and Campbelltown are facing Modbury in the other semi-final. And in South Australia, they've actually mirrored it as the A-League finals series. So it's going to work the same. We've just had the elimination finals. Now we've got the two-legged semi-finals. So that'll start this weekend. Elsewhere, in Victoria, we mentioned South Melbourne with the aesthetically not at all pleasing football that they play under Esteban Quintas have won the premiership.
Mate. Proper football.
Proper football, they call it in some parts. In my head, I call it
that's what football. I'm calling. I don't know what they call it.
Well, I don't know, man, but it's maybe not my type of football, but look, it got the results done, and they have secured the premiership in Victoria. And not just that, Melbourne Victory's youth team got promoted to the NPL in Victoria, and Preston Lions are also back up to the top division. So whether we see the Preston Lions and South Melbourne in the second division, maybe that won't happen, but we will see those two face off twice next year in the NPL. So we could definitely look forward to a really good spectacle on those two occasions, for example, there. And also Preston, with their massive fan base, being back up in the NPL is a big deal, big story in Victoria. And I'll quickly just go through some of the other leagues elsewhere. So Fort Meadow Magic edged Landon Jaffers in the Northern New South Wales National Premier League to secure the premiership there. Mindalaces, who as a club, I think can be classified friends of FPF, secured the North Zone Premier League men's premiership in the Northern Territory. But that was their second title in 3 years too. So Yeah, good job by Daniel McCormick and his team up there in the NT. In Canberra, it's actually a really interesting race at the moment too. So the ACT in Tasmania usually finish later than the other NPLs. And in the Capital Football NPL, Gungahlin United still 3 points clear with two games to play in the regular season. But they've got Canberra Croatia and the O'Connor Knights, who we saw lose to MacArthur in the Australia Cup. Those two, the two Croatian clubs, are right behind them with a couple of games to go. And then in Tasmania, it's actually been a really interesting season where in the last couple of seasons, Devonport City Strikers have totally dominated that league. Yet this year, it's actually going to be a three-way race, my apologies, heading into the final few weeks there too between South Hobart, Glenorchy Knights and Devonport. So still some drama left there. Okay. Let's finish off then. We are going to...
Cody. I'm sorry. I don't know if you brought up Gold Coast Knights, but I think they do deserve like their own mention.
Their own couple of minutes? Absolutely, yeah.
Just a minute because they play in a 22 game. They play a 22 game season. These guys went undefeated for 16 games this season. Like that's absolutely nuts. I had an 8-game winning streak in there as well. Only ended basically just towards
sorry,
the end.
Sorry, if the listeners can catch some laughing in the background, Matt has literally got a ray gun wallpaper behind his Zoom camera.
I'm glad you mentioned it, Christian, because
right now, we have to mention it.
But no, like there's 16 game undefeated run and 8-game win streak in the middle of their season. Absolutely nuts. Done some fantastic work. From what I've heard, they are probably a bit more well financially back compared to some other Queensland clubs, but the fact that they're able to still produce and they've put a side together that's done really, really well, I think they deserve a lot of credit for what they've done too.
Let's move on to our last little bit of the podcast, which is, although it did happen a while ago now, and maybe that's why Matt has put the ray gun wallpaper on, because we're about to talk about the Olympics a little bit and the Matildas campaign in the Olympics. So ray gun, I guess, is related to that. No, that's going to be harsh on the Matildas if I said who performed worse in respect to their sport, the Matildas or ray gun.
Oh, come on. That is harsh.
That's harsh. That's really harsh.
Maybe in terms of expectation when you add that into it, but come on, Ray Gunn got 0 points in breakdancing.
That's a low blow. That's a low blow. No, that's actually a low blow on both sides. This is why I should not talk about the subject, and that's why I've got you two here to talk about it instead. So, Matilda's Olympic campaign. General question. So, I've got written down here, did Australia fall short of expectations? Like, surely we can all agree here that Australia did fall short of expectations, right?
It's honestly a little bit funny.
Is that again me being too critical and harsh?
No, it's not critical because I think the expectation was we could get out of the group stage at the very least. But we've actually finished third at basically now our last three Olympic campaigns. We've just been lucky enough that the last two we were able to go through as the best third place team. The reality is, we should have this time around, and the only reason why we didn't was because we conceded 5 goals to Zambia because we decided to let Bunda have a field day. The name of the other girl that scored a brace does escape me. I do apologize, but that doesn't happen. We go through. It's genuinely very fine margins. But look, the Germany game disappointed me more from a perspective of that were very, very easy goals that we should have been able to foresee and be able to do something about, especially the second goal. You can see it off one set piece and then you do the exact same, you pull the exact same mistake on the second one. That annoys the living hell out of me. And then you go to the Zambia game and that issue keeps occurring. Then you go to the USA game and it happens again in a slightly different way. It's one thing killed this Matildas campaign and it was set pieces, and it pisses me off to all end because it's such an easy thing to work on and fix, but you can't do it. I don't get it. It's something that's what's really bugs me about this tournament, because one minor issue you fix up, we're going through.
Matt, outside of set pieces like Cody was talking about there, when you're watching the performances, were there any other glaring on-field issues that you picked out as like whoever's coming into this job next really needs to fix this moving forward?
Yeah. Firstly, I just have to get out of frame so Queen Rachel can take up most of the shot here. firstly, look.
Trying so hard not to cringe.
You guys, okay. No, the serious conversation here. You guys would know as pretty seasoned viewers of Australian national teams that this is hardly the first time the Matildas have shown up with big expectations and really sort of let it slip in a major way. I think when we look at the World Cup in France in 2019, going out at the round of 16, when we had really what was the makings of the golden generation, you know, for them to have lost in that shootout to Norway was pathetic. They failed to win the last two Asian Cups, which, like, I don't even really know how else to describe how really pathetic that is. How do you not even make the final twice, you know, of the Women's Asian Cup? Like,
before the last edition, we made the final.
Yes, we did. But we sent Thailand to penalties, a side that we beat 5-0 a month earlier. So, like, I'm just saying the Matildas are actually like Australia's perennial disappointment historically. 2023 papered over a lot of cracks. And I think the single biggest crack that we have to talk about is the fact that, like, we look at the individual quality of a lot of the players in the team. Someone like Alana Kennedy that's been there forever, you know, the rising career of a Mackenzie Arnold. And when we look at all of these women, I mean, you know, Hayley Razzo is such an incredible, you know, perennial talent for Australian football. But at the fact of the matter is most of the comments out of Europe and the USA, and especially the Americans, you know, they're all like, without Sam Kerr, they're going to be rubbish. And I'm sitting here thinking, you know, we're going to prove them wrong because we do have talented, experienced female footballers. But honestly, like, that's the tag. That's what it is, you know. And when we look at the Asian Cup, when we look at France 2019, Sam Kerr was there and we still really proved to be quite rubbish throughout. So, you know, I don't know what the specific, you know, argument is that you make towards what the root cause of a lot of that is, but the fact of the matter is, I mean, I was maybe, and remember, I went to the whole live site, was on the ABC, you know, in the pouring rain for that Germany game. We got about 10 to 15 minutes in, and I thought the campaign's already kind of low-key doomed, let alone the absolute mess that was the Zambia game. I mean, how did we go 2-5 down to the Zambian national team? That is, like, what do you even say about that? That is worse than bowing out of the quarterfinals at the Asian Cup. This team has somehow captured Australia's heart, and it's already going on a really slippery slope that I don't know the game will be able to collectively recover from. The fans will still be incredibly parochial fans, which is awesome. But the team actually really needs a massive.
I don't know if I'd call the Matildas parochial disappointments of Australian sport or anything like that. I think we haven't performed as well to expectations in Asia. I think that's probably the biggest thing you can say. And that's an indictment, I guess, of how we prepare for major tournaments. And something I put to James Johnson when I did get to speak with him when he came back from France, because I would like us to play more Asian teams in the lead up to an Asian tournament. He did mention that was something that he wanted. He wanted to make sure that players got used to playing against the Japans, the Chinas, all that. But can you please get rid of Reagan, honestly?
Sorry. Make sure she was still in shot, but you're right. We were having a serious conversation.
But man. Besides the last Asian Cup, like, we made the final of the Asian Cup tournament before that. We probably didn't play as well as what we needed to, but we were able to find our way through the tournament. I think that's one thing the Matildas have done quite well, where even if we're not playing necessarily at our best, we still have a knack of making sure we perform and we kind of meet expectations at major tournaments. You look at the Olympics, in Tony's first campaign, the Matildas didn't play well, but they just found a way to keep themselves moving through that tournament. The 2023 World Cup was probably the best I've seen us play at a major tournament, even though some games may have been a bit iffy. We had to still kind of work our way through the tournament, build up to those performances against France, against Denmark. But 2019 World Cup as well, we played four games. We won two of them and drew one. The only game we really lost was the Italy game to start off with. Yeah, we should have probably made it further in the round of 16. Penalties, unfortunately, sometimes can be a lottery. But considering, you know, the comments and the media coverage that was going on around that Matilda side after the first round loss to Italy, the way we're able to kind of come back into that tournament, you know, you talk about the miracle of Montpellier against Brazil, going to Jamaica and Sam Kerr kind of going beast mode. I'd say that was, I wouldn't, like, you're probably saying it's not a success in terms of expectations and going out the round 16, but I wouldn't say that was a tournament that we played bad at.
So moving forward, James Johnson, so that was, I was actually about to address some of the comments James Johnson made at the media briefing that you were at, Cody, and he said that the goal is to win the Asian Cup in 2026, so all the focus now moves on that. And like you said, Cody, he said that they are going to now focus on playing more Asian nations. But he still mentioned they're going to play top 10 nations as well.
Yeah, no, that's what I was about to bring up. Like, he did mention that he wanted to play those Asian nations, but he also wants to make sure we're still playing those top teams around the world because we want to be a world-class side. We're not going to be a world-class side until we're a world-class side in Asia as well. If I'm him, like, I understand where he's coming from. You bring Spain or something like that, or another big nation out to Australia, you put them at a big stadium, you fill the fucker up, you get, FA gets money, Matilda gets to play in front of 80 to 100,000 people. That's great for business. But we have an Asian Cup to win. We're not going to win the Asian Cup by consistently playing against...
Cody, can I just make a point? And I understand the golfing class. I completely understand where you're coming from. But I'd just like to point out a big reason why this Olympics campaign went so bad was also because prior to the third place playoff against Sweden, we had not played any quality opposition between then and when they first kicked off against Germany. It was a big reason why they were so underprepared for that
game. That's preparing for an Olympics tournament. We're preparing for something completely different here.
I would still take a game against quality opposition to prepare for it because a Spain or a France or whoever is in the mold of a Japan. Remember, Japan are in the Asian Cup.
I'll tell you what my rebuttal is to that, though.
Yeah.
Look at the 2022 Asian Cup. Who do we play in the lead up to that?
Was it Spain and...
We had two games against Brazil. We had two games against the USA. Both games were completely open. We were able to play our game. We were able to do the things that we want to do. And then two games into the Asian Cup, we got up against the Philippines who sit back and just look for something on the counter. Mm. And what happens? We go in half-time, nil all.
Yeah, but...
You go to South Korea. They sit every person they can behind the ball. Her name escapes me. I do apologize. The South Korean midfielder that was at Chelsea, she gets a bit of space. Boom, top bins. We're out of the tournament.
The campaign was also prone to a lot of poor decision making. Notoriously, playing a full strength 11 to beat Indonesia 18-0 was a big part of that. But I still think that you play the top 10 nations as much as you can. Get the big event while, you know, the fan support is still as it is. I really have no issues with that.
Just quickly on this though. Are the Matildas supposed to be playing top 10 nations? Because isn't that pampering some of the squad members? And isn't that kind of, you know...
Only if they're flying first class.
Giving them that luxurious service that they shouldn't be treated like professionals like that. Like that's,
how dare we try and prepare our footballers
how
for
dare they be
tournament.
Pampered by playing top 10 nations?
The Robbie Slaters of the world are the reasons why we praise Queen Rachel.
What happened to Ray Gun being done?
Yeah, I thought the Ray Gun bit was over, and I also did not ask for the Ray Gun bit on the podcast.
Firstly, I don't actually really pay attention to memes and or news. I'm just a huge fan of the Olympic Games in general. When people were doing, Tuka shooting guy, I'm just going, yeah, sorry, I'm watching Hungary in the water polo. I don't actually, cool, that's a meme now, is it?
Just quickly for you guys, who takes over from Tony? Cody, let's start with you. Who's like, I want this man or woman to take over This is the person that can lead us forward.
You need someone who can kind of build on the same culture that Tony's been able to bring in, because by all accounts, it looks like they're in a better position than what they were, at least under Milicic and before. Gustavsson did take over. It's a tight-knit group. You know, we've got players that are saying they genuinely look forward to coming into camp. But you just need someone with that little bit of extra tactical nuance. Someone that can kind of set this side up and go, this is how you're going to win a game. This is how you play to your strengths. Go and do that. Who that person is, I have no clue. There's, like, you can look at someone like Ante Juric, has a good record in Sydney. They've got a good culture around them. Joe Montemurro would have been a great name. I'm not sure what he's like as a person, but definitely as a manager, he looks like he's able to do a good job. I've heard a lot of people screaming out for Casey Stoney. Has a good record in the NWSL. Looks like a poor environment actually affected her tenure and was the reason why she was relieved, and it wasn't an environment created by her own doing. So it'll be interesting to see how she'd go in an organization where she's backed. But I wouldn't even mind them looking outside the box. If Kiznorbo didn't get snapped up by Victory, I'd ask him the question. Completely left field. I've kind of looked at every Australian manager that's
Rado Vidicic Remontada.
I don't know about anyone. Rado Vidicic. You know, not coming off a very good City stint, but if you're looking like as far left field as you could possibly get, I wouldn't be opposed to Nick Montgomery being interviewed for it.
He'll stay at Tottenham.
Look, more than likely he'd stay at Tottenham. I wouldn't blame him for staying at Tottenham, but I don't think it'd be the worst idea in the world. He's generally a great manager. Yes, he hasn't managed in women's football before, but who's to say he can't transfer his skills over?
We're about to have the under-20s World Cup. It's in like 9 days.
Maybe 11 or 12. I think it starts September.
Sorry. My body clock's all over the shop. I think it's a good testing ground for the credentials of Leah Blaney. I'm not saying Leah Blaney is my top candidate, but I'm going to be honest with you. You guys would know the story of Hester Reinderroos. She was the Dutch manager that was the Matildas manager in, I think, 2013 or 2014. This is to be fair, the argument that I'm making is pretty long-winded here, but she got done for like some abuse allegations and just like overtraining the players and bringing in this really sort of horrible technique. And she only coached a few games here or there. And then we've had this stigma around Tony G, you know, his awful decision-making. I just think that there's too much of a stigma to bringing in foreign coaches and expecting a better product because this person has experience in the US, this person has experience in Sweden, this person has experience with Dutch football. I think to hell with it. I think go back to locals and also overcome the stigma that was provided from the last local manager with the whole Stajic situation, you know, Ante Milicic having to take over the 2019 World Cup. Let's bring some heart back into Australian management. And again, low-key because of that, I think Leah Blaney might actually be my top pick.
Yeah, no, I'm not opposed to Leah Blaney either.
But honestly, because she's female.
Look, there is an absolute stigma attached to foreign coaching hires, okay? An absolute stigma, and it's clear for all to see.
Honestly, me bringing up the Hester Reinderroos thing was probably in poor taste because it was 11 years ago and you guys didn't even know who she was.
Yeah,
Marco Rudin? Wait, what?
No. I'm not looking at Leah Blaney because she's female. I think if you look too much of trying to make a social statement with a manager, you're running the risk that if it doesn't work out, people are going to be back, and it's going to create a media storm. But Leah Blaney, I think she has some genuine credentials as a manager, and if she can get this under-20 side performing at the World Cup, who's to say that the FA don't look at it and go, we've got someone internally here that's done a good job with our next generation already. Let's give her a go. Because one of the things that James Johnson really prefaced was that he wants someone that can bring in the next generation of Matildas, because he knows that there's going to come a time where some of these aging players are going to have to step aside. So who better to bring in than the person that's in charge of developing them right now?
I'm going to say that it goes beyond a social statement, though. Firstly, she would be the last female figure that's actually actively been heavily involved with the FA who probably would know a lot of the girls personally. I don't actually I know enough about her, the history of her career and how long she's been involved in the game to the extent of those relationships. But the point is they would exist. And she would be probably the only permanent female manager where a lot of that existing relationship with the FA, with the players, was in place. And I think the dynamic, when I'm talking about the relationship, I'm actually really just talking about the fact that I don't think the Australian National Women's Football Team has had a female figure that they can relate to. Okay, so it goes beyond because she's a woman. It breaks down to the fact that, like, this is something that is for the player's benefit. It's not about the fact that there is some sort of social statement being made. I'm actually thinking about it from the player's perspective. So I think, again, you'd have to look at her.
That'll do for this revival episode of the Front Page Football Podcast. Not too sure if this has been a successful revival or not, but in either case, we are back in some capacity. And I've been your host, Christian Marchetti, joined by Matt Olson and Cody Ajayda. Thanks for listening. And until next time, it's bye for now.